You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
My name is Sam. I teach at UBC at the Department of Educational Studies. It's an interdisciplinary department where we all study education from different fields. My field is philosophy. I studied philosophy of education at Ohio State University for my PhD, but probably more relevant to this class is I studied philosophy in my undergraduate program at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio, which is, for better or for worse, people have strong opinions about it. I suppose that even before that, though, I was raised in a lay Catholic missionary family, so Catholic identity is kind of, for me, it's the water I swim in, you could say, right? So over the years, I've accumulated, you might say, a broadish range, I suppose, of different senses of what this Catholic intellectual tradition is, what it's good for, what it's bad for, you know, all these kinds of things. And and so in this course, what I'd like to do is to work through that archive that is both academic, but also in some ways, you might even say confessional or autobiographical in a way. And I would like to treat it in two different ways. The first is going to take 3 days. The second is going to take 2 days. So the first version is going to be what I would call a genealogy of the Catholic intellectual tradition. Why would I use a word like genealogy when I could use a word like history or chronology or something? I wouldn't call what I'm going to do chronological or historical because I'm not a historian. And my interest isn't really to give you a sense of the history, although I think one of the kind of side benefits is that you'll have a stronger historical sensibility afterwards. But my aim is really to do more of what a genealogy does, which a genealogy is not really a family history, strictly speaking. It's a series of relations, right? And so I use the term genealogy to try to get at the point of working through this, what might seem to be historical, but what I would claim is actually a genealogical survey to show a series of relations. Some of these relations will be unexpected. For one, we won't begin to talk about overtly Catholic sources until probably the beginning of the day tomorrow. In other cases, as we cross certain important historical periods, there will be other religious traditions or places that are not principally, or in some cases are overtly anti-Catholic, that will be really important to think about as we work our way through. So these relation points, right, are really much more important to me to convey what this tradition is than giving you a sort of authoritative survey length history of the Catholic intellectual tradition. For those who came last year, you'll notice that in this case it's a shifted and in my opinion a bit more intellectual engagement with history than the just fire off, you know, version that I did in that class. Does that all make sense so far? So at the end of the 3 days, I hope to... where are we going? We're going to go from the earliest fumes left over of Persian myth into Homer all the way to Pope Francis. Okay, so that's the aim for the first 3 days, right? So we're going to work our way from this sort of oral tradition, Iliad and Torah, all the way to contemporary Pope Francis. When we get contemporary, though, I'm going to really try to stay a bit out of, you might say, the issues, and just really try to give you a sense of the relationships that work their way all the way back. There will be some points in which I'll need to overlap and double back, because the history I want to give is not a linear history that you can just cover with one thread, so I'll have to make some digressions and point to some places where things come around. I hope to be able to be generous enough and hopefully careful enough that I'll also let you know where I'm missing stuff. So in some cases, the relation will be to something that I don't know anything about, but I know that I don't know that there's something out there about this that I don't know. So one early disclaimer is, yes, this is roughly speaking going to be deeply Judeo-Christian, right? There's no question about that. And so it's going to come really through the archive of that inheritance. The second point, though, within the Judeo-Christian on the Catholic side, is going to be very, very Latin Rite. So if you're an Eastern Catholic, if you're Byzantine, if you're Orthodox, this is probably not going to tell your side of the story, right? Geographically, this is going to probably begin in the Greece, Middle East, North Africa, and work its way north and then westward. That's going to be the trajectory. Certainly, I'm going to hope to do some justice to kind of Northern Africa, Algeria, Spain, where there's some surprisingly non-Western influences. But I think in general, there's no hiding the fact that this is going to be a very kind of overtly and rather unapologetic Western account of history. It's certainly not going to engage, like I said, with anything east of the Persian Empire, you know, the ancient Persian Empire, right? So there's a lot of people left out. There's a lot of stuff left off the map. It's not intentional anymore than it's just, this is all I know. So I'm going to share that with you, and I'm not going to pretend to know otherwise, right? When we finish up the 3 days of working through this series of relations, at any point in time, feel free to ask. Maybe you'll help me find some more absences. You'll say, well, Sam, you know, you're also forgetting about this. And I'll say, no, I'm not forgetting. I just don't know anything about it. So let's mark that as another, you know, absent relation that we have there. What does an absent relation mean? Think of it as like someone reminds you at a family reunion about a set of cousins you didn't know existed. And you didn't, never get to know them. You don't go off and search for them. But you just know that they're out there. And that's about it, right? I think that's an important sensibility to have within this idea of Catholic identity or whatever that is. When we cross the 3-day mark, kind of whether we're ready or not, we're going to move into the final 2 days, in which I'll take up a completely thematic look at the Catholic intellectual tradition, not through the relations, but using the relations as kind of like a foundation, but then really kind of getting above that foundation to talk explicitly about the three transcendentals. Mm-hmm. Truth, beauty, and goodness. As a few of you have noted, my aim here is not going to be to try to make truth, beauty, and goodness familiar. I'm actually going to try and make them actually seem a bit unfamiliar. Like, wow, could truth really be about that, right? You know, and even to challenge perhaps some of the ways in which the words truth, beauty, and goodness and the concepts have been understood. To do this, I'll lean heavily on some insights from the series of relations we've looked at, but I'll also take liberties at this point to perhaps speculate a bit on my own. And the sources I'll use as inspiration, you could say, will also be thematic. And I'm just going to rely on who are hopefully familiar people. John Paul II, Benedict XVI, Francis. So our last three popes. I think our last three popes give us a really interesting thematic overview of goodness in the case of John Paul II, truth in the case of Benedict, and beauty in the case of Francis, that we can really... I think we can see some relations even there, and also between them and across them. So the final 3 days will be on this thematic analysis of the transcendentals. So we begin with genealogy, we end with themes, And then it's all done. Does that make sense for the most part? Seem reasonable? Any questions about the approach or the method? No? Okay. In terms of timing, it's 9:25 right now. The exhaustiveness of the fact that there's 3 days to do this means that I think we should probably be very generous about giving breaks and time. So I'm thinking that maybe I'll start off and we'll kind of do an hour and then do check-ins at every hour. Don't think that you can't speak for an hour, though. In the process of me working over these themes, you may find something, for instance, a particular relation that I obviously don't put a lot of importance on, you may want to really hear more about. So in that case, speak up. If I know more about it, so it could be that it's not that I'm not interested, it's just that I have I only know this much about it. So then in that case, maybe I can refer you to a source or refer you to Google or something like that. In other cases, though, perhaps there's something that you'd like to hear more about, or perhaps there's something that I'm spinning in a particular direction that you kind of say, like, well, doesn't this spin the other way too? And, you know, we can talk about that. And yeah, I welcome any kind of interactions you have along the way. So if it's okay to start, then and you can check in with me too at the hour if you're kind of like, Sam's a little bit off. I'm not the best with the clock. If we start with the book of Genesis. The first theme we hear is just Genesis 1:1, so the first creation account. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Now the earth was a formless void. There was darkness over the deep, with a divine wind sweeping over the waters. First of all, let's pay attention to form here. I read to you the written form from the written Torah, which was written down fairly late in the Jewish in Jewish civilization. So Israel, for many years, recounted this verse not through a written delivery, but through the oral Torah, which was spoken through voice, which alludes to even one of the tropes of this verse, which is divine wind. The word in Hebrew is ruach. Ruach means spirit. So some people, some translations in English have this, I think it's, takes some license, but I think it's beautiful, that the Spirit of the Lord hovered over the waters, right? Yeah, that's a gorgeous, I think, kind of idea of spirit hovering over water. What this refers to, though, is the primacy of orality, right? So the voice, the wind, this relationship between the oral, and then the second order of the written, right? Which is what I read from you today, which is, of course, a translation in English from a number of scholars. And I tend to really like this rather old translation, which is the New Jerusalem Bible. I'm a big fan of that one. But lots of options there. So this primacy of the word spoken, oral, the oral word, and the wind and breath, it brings us to really not only the beginning of Genesis, but really what I want to call the beginning of the intellectual tradition writ large. So intellectual traditions, I claim, do not begin with writing or scholarship or libraries or texts or books or manuscripts or hieroglyphs or whatever you want to call it. They really begin with this wind, word, ruach, spirit form of interaction and intercommunication. So what are the options one has within an intellectual tradition to record a series of spoken words? Well, primarily you have the arts. And by the arts here, primarily I'm thinking of two things. Poetics. So Genesis, I mean, it's not hard to recognize the form here. This form for Genesis is not principally a scientific historical account. That account hadn't been invented yet, as we'll see. It's a poetic transmission. And so poetics, especially oral poetics, contain story, contain major themes and tropes, and also contain what you might call from these traditions, not just knowledge or facts, but wisdom. Right? So the idea is that the wisdom traditions share their wisdom, communicate their wisdom through, firstly, the oral word, the oral spirit. And then secondly, these poetics often are kept alive in their particular form, not just through poetics, but even more strictly speaking, through song. So in many cases, we have poetic transmissions and deliveries that are oral, not only in their spoken orality, but they're in fact even sung, right? And obviously from the New Testament, song is not an unfamiliar theme. Perhaps David gave us our greatest songbook when it came to that. We also have his son Solomon, who has the Song of Songs, right? The song above all songs, which is the Song of Solomon. But there's nothing particularly, as far as I can tell, purely Jewish about sharing poetry and song. It goes, I think, in just about every single direction. And in particular, when you think geographically, place Greece and then place Iran right above there in that area, there were a lot of people singing songs and sharing stories, and there were a lot of wisdom traditions that had particular mythologies and particular histories that were being commemorated, memorialized, remembered.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
I'm Timothy Putnam, host of Outside the Walls, heard every weekend on Breadbox Media. Join me as we explore the foundations and implications of our faith. We'll approach Scripture and writings from the doctors and fathers of the Church, along with other ecclesial documents. Then we'll have a conversation with a guest about how our faith informs the way we approach the important issues we face every day. And together, we'll prepare to live outside the walls. For showtimes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
There were a lot of people singing songs and sharing stories, and there were a lot of wisdom traditions that had particular mythologies and particular histories that were being commemorated, memorialized, remembered. Two of those that in many ways kick off, you could say, the relations that comprise the Catholic intellectual tradition are two sets of epic poems by a poet by the name of Homer. And the two poems, of course, are the Iliad and the Odyssey. Anyone read either or both of the Iliad and the Odyssey? Okay. Good. I'll just share with you perhaps two of the more salient themes that Homer's songs raise that we might see some relations to almost immediately, of course, but especially over the course of our studies here. Let's take the Iliad and let's go towards what is approaching the very end by starting at the very beginning. So Agamemnon is the king of the Greeks. Agamemnon disrespects Achilles, his greatest warrior, a warrior who is at least partly descended from the gods, by taking one of his wives. Achilles is so angry at Agamemnon for his dishonor that he refuses to fight for the Greeks in the Trojan Wars, and he goes back to his camp with his small army and just hangs out. Right. the war with the Trojans rages on, and at a certain point it becomes clear that the Greeks are on the losing side of the battle. Achilles is, in some translations, lover, in other cases, best friend. No need to figure out that relationship exactly, but Achilles' closest person in the camp, Patroclus, who loves Achilles deeply, but also loves the Greeks. He can't bear to see the dead coming in and to see Greece losing in this way. So Patroclus sneaks into Achilles' armor. And not just his armor, but the Greeks had a sense of spirit where they believed that when he came out, he didn't just look like Achilles, but it felt like it was Achilles, right? He took on Achilles' person, you could say, and led Achilles' army under false pretenses, mind you, into battle, where they advanced. And as if you read the Iliad, no one really quite gets an edge over the other. It's fairly balanced in that respect. But eventually, Hector, the great warrior of the Trojans, kills Patroclus, Achilles' greatest friend. And Achilles finds out after the fact that not only did Patroclus in some ways deceive him, but Patroclus was killed. So Achilles loses his best friend. He's outraged. He's, just torn apart by the death of his friend. And he wants to avenge Patroclus by fighting Hector, you know, man to man, you could say. Now, Achilles is aware, though, of a prophecy that has been told about him. Namely, that this very decision of whether he goes out to the battlefield and fights Hector to avenge his friend Patroclus, that if he does that, not that he'll lose, but that he's going to die, that he'll become mortal. However, if he stays back away from the fray, kind of like the gods do throughout the book, kind of in their own mountain and having their own things going on, that in that case, he'll live forever. So Achilles faces the basic question of, do I want to die so as to live forever in eternal memory, or shall I live yet die in terms of eternal memory and all that? So it's a paradox, right? But it's a paradox, hopefully, that Christians in particular could recognize. Do I choose death in order to live? Or do I live and accept the death that comes with it? It's this perennial question of immortality, right? And of course, he chooses to die and therefore live in this Achilles situation where Paris, the sort of guy who kicked off this whole war, ends up shooting him through the Achilles tendon, and that ends up, he dies after that. There's a lot to say here, but hopefully the theme of immortality just rings really big and heavy in that story. And I would say that that ringing of that question, should I live or should I die? But not just the easy question, but should I die in order to live? Or should I take the easier route and live, but then in some sense accept death? I mean, this is, you could say, the birth of true existentialism, right? It's a deep human question that is certainly not told for the first time by Homer. It's certainly not sung about for the first time by the Greeks. But this particular account has, you could say, outlasted perhaps other accounts in other cases. So that's the first theme that we can think of here. There are probably many stories of its time. In fact, many classicists and scholars believe that a number of the stories for the Greek imagination really came from the Persians, much like the Roman imagination, as we'll see, was in many ways informed by the Greeks. You know, this kind of, when people live next door, your neighbor ends up, you become your neighbor, whether you like it or not, and whether you like them or not, too. as we'll see, the Persians weren't the best friends of the Greeks, but nonetheless, these stories probably owe a relation back that maybe even they might not want to admit. Mm-hmm. Any questions about that theme or that story?
Well, it brings me a very interesting question that mean in relation to the assisted suicide. People were just thinking that they want to die for dignity.
So, sure.
Yeah. So is dignity some kind of, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to they bring dignity as something equal to eternal life?
Yeah. I mean, so this is actually a really salient point. It's not, when I talk about intellectual tradition and I start with arts and poetics and stuff, these aren't like detached things from everyday ordinary life. Believe it or not, people have been living and dying for a long time, right? And how to make sense of that and how to choose, right? So, you know, I really don't want to get into anything related to what we might call the politics of the question in the contemporary sense, but alongside living and dying has been questions of suicide, questions of can I really choose to die in a way that is morally related to living forever? And what's the difference between Achilles choosing that? And so you see, I mean, it raises a hotbed of questions. But the thing that I hope that this brings some sense of consolation to is that these aren't new questions, and these aren't problems that have ever been, you could say, fixed or solved. Although I do think you can say that there is wisdom that we can find when we listen closely to some of these themes and to what might be important about them and what they raise in us, right? The second story is the Odyssey. You could say, and I think you would be right to say, that the Odyssey simply replays that big theme of immortality on a minor theme. Okay, that's fine. But I think the minor theme is important in and of itself. And I even suspect in some ways that this might even itself be a different theme. So the Odyssey is after the Iliad. So after the Greeks and the Trojans fight. And Odysseus, who it figures in as like the, he's like the complementary opposite of Achilles. So Achilles is strong, but Achilles, you know, goes into battle. He's strong, but he's full of thumos. So this kind of he reacts and responds all the time. Whereas Odysseus is, you could say, the wise and cunning version of Achilles. And Odysseus and his small army are trying to return home. Where's home? Home is Ithaca. Yet on the way, Odysseus is taken through, really, it's almost like, it's not just the, it's also like a psychedelic Iliad. Like, it's the most crazy turns and bouts and bits of misfortune and seductions and meeting centaurs and, like, you know,
Sirens.
Yes, exactly. There's
Cyclops,
exactly. Yeah. Actually, I meant to say Cyclops. I said centaurs instead. Yeah. I don't think there are centaurs, by the way, in the Odyssey. Sorry. The point, though, is that Odysseus can't seem to be able to get home. But Odysseus is fueled by nostalgia, which means longing for home, trying to get home. And he finds some magnificent places, and they say, like, stay here with us forever. And he's like, oh, no, I need to go home. So he keeps trying to go home. Think of every Hollywood movie that's built on an Odyssean theme, right? Every novel. There's so many of them. Ice Age, totally Odyssean, right? You know, and I mean, highbrow stuff, right? You know, only the highbrow for me. When Odysseus gets home, he can't go home because his home has been occupied, as it were, by suitors for his wife, Penelope, who were everywhere. And if they know that it's him, they might try to kill him. So he tries to get back, you know, and kind of reclaim his home. But the whole idea of the Odyssey is that the theme is homecoming and nostalgia, about our desires for home, about what the nature of home is, about whether home is a place or home is a thing or home is a mood or home is love. And so, you know, hopefully just as immortality raises certain questions about life and death, of course, also the irony of immortality that Homer gives us, where you choose to live by dying and all that kind of stuff. In this case, it's about home, resting place, belonging, but it's also about a sense of unrest and the unrest that comes with not being at home. So when you hear a line like I'll talk a great deal about, not today, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee, this is an Odyssean theme. Right? This is a theme that is bringing us to bear on everything. And so I think that while the Iliad raises, you could say, the existential question of should I live or should I die, and what is a good life and what is a good death, the Odyssey raises the question of where do I belong? To whom do I belong? What is this longing inside me for belonging, right? And this can become, of course, deeply political. If you want to make it that quickly, you can understand the sense of nationalism or patriotism. Patria, after all, refers back to a sense of home of sorts. It can lead to familial relations. It can lead to national relations. It can lead to ecclesial relations. It can turn very violent. It can be sort of, you could say, distorted in any direction. I often write these days about what I call nostalgia for nostalgia. So my experience of reading the Odyssey as someone who's never lived anywhere for more than 2 years is, gosh, it seems really nice to be able to experience nostalgia where you know where your home is and you can long for it. I long for that kind of longing. In other words, my relationship to nostalgia, I find, is somewhat displaced, right? I long to be able to long for that easy, clear Ithaca shining out there, right? Yeah.
It's like kind of when you watch black and white films sometimes, and they long for something, and through that you kind of have a vicarious longing.
Totally, yeah. So there's a kind of nostalgia that isn't just direct, right? It's sort of indirect in that it's doubled up inside of a sense. And this sense of nostalgia, by the way, it can also be deeply false, where you project desires into desires and then you come out with this other thing. So, you know, whenever people long for the 1950s, you know, it's like, oh, that's interesting. What about the 1950s? Like, exactly, concretely, do you long for? And they'll list this litany of things that you might say, oh, well, what about the stuff that actually happened during the 1950s? You know, like, you know, so nostalgia is a difficult thing, as is immortality, with your example, right? You know, I mean, these are all not direct, deliverable themes that we can just put in our pocket and walk with. These are things to really struggle with, to think about, to contemplate.
It could be the cause of unpeaceful life.
Completely. Yeah. Yeah. So the theme of peace actually runs through both of these, right? So this idea of finding rest, you know, has a great degree to do with all these things. And I think that we could probably sit here and multiply the derivatives, right? Just maybe forever, you know. And in some ways, the next 3 days are going to be doing nothing other than multiplication of the ways in which these things can be built up. Are there critiques of this? Yeah, some people say there needs to be more than just two stories or poems or songs, and there need to be more than just two themes in, like, life and death and home. Feel free to add others. I'm just going to stick with the two for now, mainly because I've never found them to be anything but inexhaustible. So I'm sure there's other inexhaustible stories and themes out there, but the whole point is that insofar as anything is inexhaustible, it's really good at doing this sort of work, and so I don't think we need to feel, you know, too weird about that.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
This is Allison Gingras, host of A Seeking Heart with Allison Gingras, your on-air book club. A Seeking Heart features daily live discussions, weekly giveaways, and author interviews. We don't just review books, we share them, and you're invited to participate by calling in or posting your comments on social media. The best part, no reading necessary. I got you covered. please visit a Seeking Heart show page on breadboxmedia.com for show times and featured books.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
So I'm sure there's other inexhaustible stories and themes out there, but the whole point is that insofar as anything is inexhaustible, it's really good at doing this sort of work, and so I don't think we need to feel, you know, too weird about that. Genesis, you might say, why doesn't Genesis get a play up there? Genesis raises its own set of themes that come to us through the Jerusalem line more than through the Athens line. But we can take it even from that just first basic passage I gave you, through which I sort of introduced this theme. But I think the Torah really gives us a sense of, in the first place, the idea of firstness, the idea of a beginning. It might sound almost, you could say, like so obvious it's not interesting that the beginning itself would become a theme. But this idea of there being a sense of primacy in the order of things, that something comes first, right? This is not, you might say, something that we just, you know, come up with one day. This is a sensibility that I think Genesis gives us in a deep way. I think the other thing, though, that Genesis forces us to face through a very poetic meditation, which is the question of what we might call metaphysics. Now, metaphysics for the Greeks, I think, is much more tied in to the question of the good life, you know, and that stuff. For the Jews, I think they raise it in a more stark way, as we see in Genesis, which is really the confrontation with nothingness, which raises the question of nihilism, right, of nothingness itself. So the movement of the beginning is not just a vague placeholder, but it's a metaphysical movement. What does metaphysics mean? But basically the study of and the questioning of the movement from nothing to something. And the question of why is there something where there could be nothing. I mean, Genesis in some ways it's not really about creation as much as it's about the possibility of nothingness. Nothingness in Genesis is not just this sort of category that exists for the sake of creation. Nothingness has, you could say, a real place, a reality, right? And it's there, you could say, whether the creator chooses to create or not. There's something about the nothing that even flirts with becoming the first something, right? And this is where we see the paradox movement again. So the first something we see is the void. So a lot of people like to think that God in Genesis sort of redeems the nothing with something. That's one reading. That's fine. It's a perfectly fine reading. But perhaps we could even imagine it in more stark terms, where God presents himself as the void. So we think later of things like the dark night of the soul, and we think of, you know, apophatic theology, understanding God not through apprehending what God is, but through the experience of the nothing, of the absence of God. When we think of Mother Teresa's diaries, when we think of the question of nihilism in the presence of should I live or should I die, or the absence of home, you can see how this, like, whoa, 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 it just starts to bundle and it just runs off with things. But I think that that's another place where when we put Athens, what becomes Athens, obviously this, we're before Athens here. When we put Greek and Jewish thought together, they get along quite nicely. I think you can see how they, you know, they really inform each other in terms of these really big themes. Now, there are historical questions of, like, were the Jews themselves influenced by Hellenism? Hellenism goes back to Helen, the person who Paris, in this case, stole from the Greeks and the Trojan Wars. So Hellenism is again takes us back to the Iliad, but it also takes us to the question of sort of to what extent was especially Judaism in the same geographic location as Hellenism, and of course the same argument. This is the one that's made of Persian, you know, ideas and stuff like that. But this isn't history. This is genealogy. So like, don't have to get into that, I guess. Just to give you one more sort of creation or decreation story that has always struck me as being deeply moving. If we go completely across to somewhere that would have had no interaction whatsoever with the Greeks or with Israel or with anyone, if we go to to Mesoamerica, to Central America, to the Mayan myth of creation. It's called the creation of the Popol Vuh. I'll write that down. It might be worth looking at the myth of the Popol Vuh, the story of the Popol Vuh. When I use the word myth for a long time until we get to a certain point, I'm not using it as not true. I'm using it as containing wisdom. Myth means a story that has wisdom in it, right? So the modern use of the word myth tends to be a negative remark on myth. But in this case, myth is a story that is more than a story. It's a story that contains wisdom. So the Popol Vuh myth is about the way in which the creator calls human beings into their form from corn. And so corn has this relationship to creation, which is very similar to the dirt story. In fact, you could say, well, where does corn grow? But dirt, right? You know, you can start to see the ways in which, like, these stories and songs and poems and myths about anything related to first things, anything related to fundamental things, has a capacity to, be integrated in a very rich way into any version of Hellenism, which is largely going to be the story I work with. So that's just one example of another place where you can start thinking in this mythopoetic way. Yeah?
I was thinking, like, I guess there would have been no contact between Mesoamerica and...
None that I can
know, but is there something with the structure of the human mind that in different cultures, different times, these things...
Sure.
Like language, for instance, right?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this gets us into the questions of, like, the sort of philosophical anthropology. Like, so is there something common to the human person that you could say hardwires our imagination for these kinds of stories? I mean, I don't want to get too cognitive because I just don't know anything about that, and I wonder about some of the assumptions that the cognitive argument makes. But I will say this, that the approach I'm taking, while I'm trying to be sort of careful on the front end, it does have a hard anthropological assumption built into it. Namely, that the imagination of the human person is deeply inscribed with wonder and with an appetite for wisdom, right? And that this idea of dignity itself is but a sign of this deeply wondrous and deeply urging appetite for wisdom. Now, you could say there are other appetites too that maybe compete with that, and it's an argument to be had, and it's something that I could be more careful with. But that's the basic, you could say, humanist anthropology of my approach. And so it's not quite saying in exact terms this sort of that it's mind, because of course what mind is, especially for the Greeks, which is this beautiful, not particularly cognitive idea of mind that we'll get to in a bit, is a question. I do take it as given, right, for all of these lectures and for this class, that the human person and really the entire created order is contains, you could say, this aspect of its internal structure is imbued with something that I think that we can both that is wonderful in itself, and that the human mind in particular loves to wonder about. Yeah.
Do you believe in something like the religious sense, like he talks about, where it's this kind of, it's like global appetite for the eternal, the mystery, you know?
Yeah, I mean, my worry about the religious sense is it just gets, it flies away really quickly. So this is where I'd rather talk about story and song and myth and stuff. But yeah, I think that I can't think of a people who share language who don't almost immediately decide to share language around some sort of transcendental order. For some, they may not require a deified system to do that, right? Sikhism in this sense comes to mind. There's a few others. But many of them find a deified system as a useful set of analogies and relations to make sense of this. Some of them use a deified system to come up with better stories, like the Greeks, mythology, you know, which isn't the most, I would say, soaring wonder of deities, right?
No,
they're always fighting and, you know, trying to manipulate things and, you know.
Cheating on each other.
Totally, yeah, exactly. Adulterous and all that kind of thing. But the point is, though, is that, yeah, I would, I mean, I agree. What that means, though, is that this religious sense, though, isn't so much rooted in any kind of systematic religion, like a state of theses or whatever, but it's rooted in what we might call a condition that all of us can get around, which is maybe built on a simple premise. Everybody dies, right? Like you can do a lot of work with that premise, right?
Oh, sure.
You know, and then you work your way from there. You know, so that's a very Iliad built thing. Or everybody belongs or should belong. That's a bit more speculative, right? But you can work your way a long ways with that. Or everything begins, right?
Does everyone want to appease the gods in some ways, or that too is reaching too far?
It depends what kind of gods that people comes up with, right?
Yeah, okay.
You know, some cases what is pleasing to God is the good, right?
Yeah.
And when we read Plato, I mean, it's like, is goodness what is pleasing to the gods, or is goodness the thing that pleases the gods, which are two different things, right?
Yeah.
So is goodness appealing to the desires of the gods, or are the desires of the gods themselves, you could say, extractable to some essence of goodness itself? Like, is it just that, like, the gods like this, or is it what being godlike is itself that becomes the good, right? I mean, that's a whole, like, you know, rabbit hole that the Greeks struggle with and many other people struggle with. But this is where hopefully I'm opening up enough questions that we can get by for a while on, in that when we do get to the transcendentals, these are not the fixed eternal categories that sign directly to some really clear thesis. These are really three extracted parts of a grand human anthropology that the Catholic tradition has specifically, through the Greeks, but also through Judaism and other sources, been able to use in a very holistic, even you could say Trinitarian way. But what does that use look like? Well, it sure doesn't look like, you know, something technical or technocratic. What they do is they consistently move us and arouse these early basic stories and questions, and they don't let them leave our mind. One quick comment on education here before I move on. I know I have a few educators in the room. I have two basic assumptions. One is the one I said, of that the human person is basically, you could say, imbued with this desire for wisdom. The other one, though, is that whatever education itself is always attached to that desire for wisdom that takes us back, you could say, or forward, or whatever direction you want to, into these gigantic, huge questions. So if you want to think of, like, what is a Catholic education? Well, Catholic education isn't necessarily about Catholic identity. It's just about this shared anthropological sense that we actually share with a number of different traditions. I find it very, very easy to talk in this way with Jews or with Muslims or with people who have some relations in this genealogy that are in some ways Hellenic and have these kind of things. I find it difficult myself to talk to Hindus, not because I don't like them or because we don't, but because the relations in that case become slightly different, and so it's I have to work really hard actually to find my way. But then I'll hear a story or a song that I say, oh wow, that's about life and death, and I'm, well, of course it is. I'm like, oh great, okay, we share that, right? I struggle even more with Confucianism, and a lot of people say, oh Sam, things you say strike me as being very, you know, Confucian. I'm like, oh great. And so I've read the Tao, and I read the verses, and I can recognize the form, right? It's poetic, fine, no problem with it. I can get a feeling in my tummy that, like, maybe this is this, that, or the other. But, of course, my biases prevent me from being able to feel awash in it. But then I read Western literature, which is, of course, has its own ideas about, you know, Confucianism and other ideas like that, Hinduism. And sometimes I can be like, oh, yeah, well, that's very much just what I did to the Popol Vuh. Or in some cases, if I find it hard, I say, oh, wow, this is probably really authentic because I can't quite get into it very well, right? You know, these biases, I don't think they have to play out, though, on a political scale, though. I think that it's just the manifestation of this anthropology isn't as universal as we would want any anthropology to be, right? I think we can agree to that, you know. So language here interferes. The relationship between language and culture interferes. A lot of things interfere with our ability to see what is universal and what is particular, right? But my claim is that education that's not attached really closely to this anthropological sense should really not be called education. It should be called credentialing or schooling or training or something that's really put into the more everyday, perhaps important, but not, you know, what I consider to be sort of education writ large. Okay, so we have this sort of foundation that I hopefully have laid carefully enough that I'm really going to take off from with the Iliad and the Odyssey.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
This is the Bible study evangelista, Sonia Corbett, inviting you to join me for some Bible study spinach that tastes like cake here on Breadbox Media. My scripture study series are created with you in mind to help you make a space in your busy heart and busy schedule for God to love and lift you all the way up into His lap. And there, all you've been given is loved and lifted too. So tune in to Bible Study Evangelista here on Breadbox Media, live or by podcast. It's Bible study in your pocket.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Okay, so we have this sort of foundation that I hopefully have laid carefully enough that I'm really going to take off from with the Iliad and the Odyssey. But here are the next set of themes that I want to raise that are not so much about what is real or what is important or what is big, but are really about the move from the oral to the written and the, you could say, the controversy of that translation from spoken to written and what we should expect of the written. And this takes us into basically the history of history. So during the wars between the Greeks, and why is it always war? I don't know. Why couldn't it be love? I don't know. There's a lot of love in war, though. This is what the Greeks show us. So. But the Greeks, and some of you will recognize the story, are fighting the Persians, right? The Persian Empire is just above them. It's large. It's menacing. And it looks south to Greece, and Greece looks ripe for the picking. Greece is not doesn't have a strong city-state nationalist arrangement, so they seem very kind of vulnerable, you could say. For whatever reasons, the Persians and the Greeks are fighting. The Greeks are fighting to preserve themselves from the Persians. I'm sure there's a Persian account of the story that says that the Greeks were actually the ones who started it all. Okay, fine, that's all fine. But we have a person named Herodotus who wants to record an account of the Persian wars. And Herodotus is very familiar, of course, with the account of the Trojan Wars that Homer gave in the Iliad. But Herodotus doesn't so much want to write the poetic, mythic narrative of Homer. Herodotus wants to write what he ends up titles his writing as, the histories. He wants to write history, which is still story, right? But is, in this case, a deviation from the first oral poetic mythic tradition and moves into this more historical tradition. So what is history when you read Herodotus? Has anyone read the histories? Okay, you know, either excerpts or, Well, first of all, to the layperson like me... They sound a lot like Homer. Like, the gods are still being invoked, and genealogies are still running through, and it's kind of like, okay, so how is this history and not myth, you know? But you can also see, though, that there's a sense in which what Herodotus is trying to do is he's trying to have some corresponding fidelity between the thing there and the person who's describing the thing there. It's not just all coming out internally. There's an external, you could say, empirical object out there to be described. And so that's Herodotus' take. Now, the actual Persian wars result in the creation of a defensive Greek unit called the Delphian League. And the Delphian, named after the oracle at Delphi, was the, you could say, the alliance between the different Greek city-states. And so it really creates some of the earliest ideas of the polis or the nation amongst kind of like the provincial arrangement, of, you know, things like that. And there were two polises, two city-states that really stood out within the Delphian League as being the places that that really had the most military power and the most political will. Those would obviously be Sparta and Athens, right? Sparta is very well known for its army. Athens not only was very mighty in its military strength, but it's also a port city, so it had an economic, cosmopolitan, slightly more cosmopolitan identity. As these things tend to happen, we're together when we're fighting against the enemy out there. But when we're done fighting the enemy out there, who becomes the enemy? Our closest friends that we were fighting with, right? So Sparta and Athens become rivals within the Delphian League. And after some time, it kicks off kind of like a civil war between Sparta and Athens. And this war... is captured by another historian who wants to do, you could say, in a vague sense, the historical work that Herodotus did, as opposed to, you could say, that the mythic poetic work of Homer. But Thucydides decides to do this crazy thing where he actually goes to the places that the thing is taking place and like takes notes and actually like records what's going on and writes about it in a more, you could say, proto-journalistic style. Now, to our ears, it kind of sounds crazy. Like, well, obviously that's what you do. Well, right, but that's the inheritance of the of Thucydides' approach to recording what we now would call history. So, one of the basic questions that emerges from the interaction between Herodotus and Thucydides is really the question of fact and is it different from wisdom? And the distinction between myth on the one hand and something like journalism on the other. And the ways in which you might say, depending on which side you favor, one might be inclined to say, oh, Thucydides advanced, you could say, the science of history to the point at which the Iliad and the Odyssey just became old kind of repositories of look how backwards we used to be. We used to think this was, you know, serious business. And look at how we started off with such an arcane method, and now we're into the real good stuff, right? And we can really refine. Well, that's a very particular way of reading this. It's a very modern, very progressive, very, in some ways, scientific way of thinking about this. But I think there's some other ways of thinking about it. In other words, what's lost from here to here? Notice, the thing that stands out about Thucydides is not so much his stories and the questions they bring, but really the sophistication of his method. So we see that there's something about this movement from poetics to journalistic, empirical history that actually loses and actually disenchants and actually reduces itself to the technical, which is method, right? And so we become, you could say, awestruck not by the question of should I live or die, but instead we're awestruck with, wow, how good are your notes? And so this transition from early ontogenetic story and myth into the attempt to use this style in a more or less historical way into the very early beginnings of a historical account in itself, it can be read as a story of progress, and in many respects it is that. But I think it can also be read as a story in and of itself of the loss of a certain kind of memory and a certain kind of desire for memory related to wisdom. So we live in an era today where there, I'll go back to education because that's kind of my bag, right? Where there are a lot of people who believe that education is principally, primarily, if not completely, the question of method, right? Methods, that's like all you learn in most teacher education programs, which is how, the question of the how. Educational researchers ask them what their research question is, and 95% the first word will be how, which is reducible to method, right? The reduction to method, though, itself in education is precisely the reason why I want to insist at the front end that any sense of education that isn't attached to the big transcendental, universal, foundational, metaphysical, Genesis-like themes, and is instead, now I could say, simply attached to method, is really not... It's technical, but it's not, I would say, real, right? It's reducible to really just technique. Think about a chef, right? I would submit that to be a great chef, a memorable chef, not only a chef who cooks a good meal, but an artist in and of themselves as a chef, that they have to first and foremost love not just food as a product or as an ingredient, but they have to have almost a higher order love of a certain kind of beauty that manifests itself through the culinary, that manifests itself through the interaction between the body and the senses and external things, that manifests itself in ecology and in nature, and that manifests itself in chemistry. And you see what I'm saying? Like, they have to have a huge... You might say, not even explicit to themselves, but that without this, if they're simply amazing at using a knife, they could be a great line cook. But they can't be a chef of this kind, right? They don't have, you might say, the breath in order to take it. Now, you could say that of their interests, they're only interested in this very particular way of cooking. But even people who specialize in a way of cooking, a method of cooking, you'll find that not only their tastes, but their references are never confined by that way. Right? A chef who is trained in classic French cuisine and won't cook anything else for anyone else, very likely eats lots of different kinds of food with gusto, right? A person who's trained in Japanese traditional cooking, first of all, there's no such thing as traditional in any of these senses. French cuisine has evolved, you know, forever, so has Japanese cuisine, so has everything, right? But my point, though, is that the reduction to method is a theme that I think we're very familiar. In fact, it may be the more familiar theme. A lot of people, in fact, that I speak to, find more familiarity with the obsession with method than they do with the question of should I live or should I die. And this, I want to claim in a very critical way, is what we might call the late modern predicament. So we've forgotten in some ways the early first questions, and we've obsessed, and I would say over-obsessed, to a point in the question of method.
But this conflict still exists today, doesn't it? Like, even here...
I would say it is the very conflict, yeah.
Like, what's the point of liberal arts, as people say?
Yeah.
Like, what's the point of that? We can't even... It has such a huge importance in our society and how we need to train students. This is why the curriculum is changing.
Yeah.
So that we have more inquiry-based learning. So yeah. How to reach, how to think, how to find, how to ask questions.
Right.
Which, like, method and science and straight facts don't teach.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And even the question of how to do inquiry is not really, it's still a method question, right? So, like, I mean, I teach in a BN program, so, like, everyone's like, okay, you're a philosopher, how do we do inquiry? I say, stop asking how.
But still, Sam, you still have a purpose of, you know, using this method, right? You still have a theme.
Sure.
Why are you choosing to use this method?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You want to bring out something that will actually more effective.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is a good point. So I have strong opinions about the distinction between method and one. I don't want to claim, as you're very helpfully making, that all method is reductionist. There are better and worse methods, and you could come back and say, well, Sam, you're using a very particular method, you know, here. So it's not to say, because by the way, Homer had a method too, didn't he? Right? So it's not to say that method itself is the enemy. You're absolutely right. But it is to say that the movement from the question to the how, from the big why and what, right, to the how, it's that movement that I want, in some sense, want to say that I'm opposed to. It's not, as you very, very clearly help me out with here. It's not that I want to say that method itself is somehow, we can't think about that. Yeah, yeah.
To define whether you move towards the method or the why, don't you need a greater metaphysic of what is the good that's being obtained through those two approaches, or a combination of the two?
That's one method for doing it. And so, like, so when we find Thomas Aquinas, or later when we find really Aristotle, you'll start to see that, like, there's this very particular way of doing this, which is to begin with transcendental. And you'll notice in my emphasis that I do have, even you could say, a very particularly scholastic sense of the big things, where I'm a little bit different from my dear, 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 wonderful Dominican friends, the Thomists, is that I don't know if we have to start with, like, the good. In fact, I think the good comes to us first in story and song, and not really in principle, right? Not to cite my own work, but one of my claims I make in my most recent book is that art precedes metaphysics, which gets to your question. So really, before we're cashing and hashing out first principles, we're singing and sharing and telling stories, right? And
I don't know if I agree with you, but you did address the question, so that's
good. Yeah, I mean, no, so for me, I'm so, like, wildly, and you might say idiosyncratically, like, bent against this movement that I even want to call metaphysics another reduction to method and go and reach back, right? So, but by the way, this is not a standard or common view at all. This is, Sam is kind of nuts and thinks these things. This is not something you should, you know, write down as anything that anyone thinks other than your crazy professor. But good. I feel strongly like you all both are able to understand the parts and the whole. This is really important. So, good. Yeah.
Did you mention Persia, or were you coming to that?
All I wanted to mention about Persia was a little bit that probably these stories don't come, aren't really patriated in Greece. They're probably built on, you know, so like Gilgamesh is one example of a place where we find the similar stories and stuff like that. But Gilgamesh is where, like, that's like my big wall that I run into. I prefer to stick to, for these purposes, I prefer to stick here for strategic methodological reasons because it gets me to this nice contrast between this and that. But yeah, other than that, anything you want to add?
I just know nothing about pre-Islamic Persian thoughts.
Really. Oh, well, this is a really, also, so like I would recommend that you really like look into the really modern-day Iran, because today in Iran there is a really interesting kind of trifecta of interests that are built really in some ways along questions of nostalgia and stuff like that. Let me give you a brief example. The only reason I know this is I have the wonderful fortune at UBC to teach a lot of people from a lot of different places, and I have one student who I think is just really great at carving out this trifecta. So I'm taking it from him. His name is Taha. So there is obviously the Islamic State, which is the people who sort of appeal to Islam, which on this historical record is not the really super old in an impressive way to Middle Eastern culture. So there are people who oppose the what they would call the conservative Islamic State sympathizers with this grand Persian narrative, right? The whole that oh well, we are inheritors of an early secular Persia within which, you know, the empire was you know, millennia before Islam, and so because there's this whole thing about, like, you know, to be Persian is not to be Arabic, because obviously, you know, these are different languages, different cultures, you know, things like that. And so now by the way, this nostalgic narrative going back to like the like pristine cosmopolitan Persian Empire are probably false, nostalgic, and they can actually be quite in some ways anti-Islamic in certain ways, very in this sort of, but they're really like a modern secular spin on ancient Persia, and they create this kind. And then you have the people in between who are like the nostalgic, you know, for Alexander people who are so supposedly so enlightened, don't really get it, and neither do the, you know, Sharia law people. But here we might be Muslims ourselves, or we might be this or that or whatever, but they kind of trying to seek a kind of, you might say, a middle way. You can see, though, in that narrative there that there's a lot at stake in the way of identifying these. And so even like the Farsi language, you know, and whether it should be, what it should be called and stuff, they're all built into it. But I don't know enough about that. I want to learn more, though, because I think that in particular, I think a lot about the relationship between Christianity and Islam in particular, right? And we'll hear more about that. And the relationship of Islam and Arabic in particular to the Greeks itself is a huge, huge thing that I'm going to give hopefully ample time to pointing out. But it's this relation that goes a little bit eastward, right? Between for instance, between Islam and the kind of more, you could say, older, you know, cultural heritage of, you know, for instance, like the Persian Empire and a place like Iran. That really falls outside of my purview, but it's definitely another relation in the genealogy that I think that couldn't do anything but help us to understand this better.
This is Sam Rocha, and you have been listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Jeff Young, the Catholic foodie and host of the Catholic Foodie Show, where I provide Catholic culinary inspiration to help you grow in faith around the table of the Eucharist and around your family dinner table at home. From food in the Bible to recipes you can make in your own kitchen to stories and interviews that highlight the importance of shared meals with family and friends, you'll find inspiration and encouragement to get into the kitchen and around the table. It's the Catholic Foodie Show, where food meets faith. Check out my show page at breadboxmedia.com for details and showtimes. breadboxmedia.com.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.